104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
A very good afternoon, everybody. Flight to Classics is brought to you today by 4Play Delhi Sheraton Mall and this radio station, the Big 104 in a class by itself.
Trini Guyanese cuisine at its best.
4Play Delhi's got it.
We've got that taste you won't forget.
4Play Delhi.
Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great service with a smile, got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list. You just can't refuse it at 4Play Delhi. We got the taste you won't forget.
4Play Delhi, located in Sheraton Mall.
Good afternoon and welcome aboard Flight 104 to Classics. Today, our aircraft is under the command of Captain Phil Forrester. The captain has informed me that our flying time will be approximately 3 hours to Classics International Airport. At this time, we ask that you fasten your seatbelts and increase the volume levels in your system as we perform our demonstration. Thank you for your attention. We will be airborne shortly.
Oh yeah, I like it a lot. A very good afternoon, everybody. Captain Forrester is once again in the cockpit of this magnificent aircraft. And we are heading to Classics International Airport. Let me apologize humbly for a marginally late departure this afternoon. As a result of an inrush of passengers assembled at the Grantley Adams International Airport to board this flight. And by the way, the flight is totally overbooked, so we apologize to all of you. But by the way, though, technology is billowing out of everywhere, so you can link this flight on the beat, 104.1fm.com, all right? But anyway, we are on the way to Classics International Airport, and we are using runway 09, so therefore we take off towards the east of Barbados, and at 2,500 feet, we'll make a left turn over our northern coast. Along the way, you will see the Crane Beach Hotel, and of course, the Wyndham Sam Lawrence Castle. The historic Bridgetown Port will be away in the distance to our left. And as we exit the island, the billowing smoke you'll notice coming out of the cement plant there in Checker Hall, St. Lucie, will be absolutely optical. We take a northerly direction over the northern coast of St. Lucia. It's a clear day. Grosley and Cap Estates will be exactly below us. We'll take a left turn over Martinique into the Western Caribbean on our way to Classics International Airport. Now, despite the fact that the radar is saying that there will be some precipitation along the way, 20 miles east of Hispaniola, I can assure you it will be absolutely innocuous, as this aircraft is designed to stand resolute against the attack of any adversarial weather. So essentially, it will be a smooth flight to Classics International Airport. Now, you heard before, I am your ordained Minister of Classics, certified. Therefore, I'll be playing you some classics this afternoon that will bring you oceans of delight, not to mention those delicious meals from 4Play Delhi will be served in abundance as well. So it will be a smooth and exciting flight to Classics International Airport. Flight attendants, prepare for departure and cross check.
Chinese cuisine at its best.
4Play Delhi's got it.
We've got that taste you won't forget.
4Play Delhi.
Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great service with a smile, got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list. You just can't refuse it at 4Play Delhi. Taste you won't forget.
4Play Delhi, located at Sheraton Mall.
The Beat 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
Oh yeah, I like it a lot. It is exactly 3:30. And I just want to say to you once again, because I've said it before, so I'm actually plagiarizing myself in this regard, that Flight to Classics isn't a journalistic forum. It is a forum in which we play loads of music, information. We have some fun in the Sunday afternoons and take you back to places you've been before. And additionally, we invite Barbadian professionals who have contributed significantly to our national development to sit in front here and, you know, sort of tell their stories. And many have been stories of encouragement to those people who believe that because we came from ground zero, we got to remain there. You know what I'm saying? And we've heard some of the most incredible stories from these guys, be it politicians. We've had medical doctors here. We've had professors. We've had musicians. Right across the professional divide in Barbados have come to Flight to Classics in this rather relaxed atmosphere and have told us their incredible stories. So today, I believe, will be no exception in this regard. Now, today's featured guest is a distinguished Barbadian government official who has, over the years, made an outstanding contribution to national financial governance. He received his early education at Wesley Hall Primary and Cumbermere School, respectively, before moving to the University of the West Indies Cahill Campus, York University, Canada, and the University of Manchester to further his academic acumen in economics and finance. It is indeed my immeasurable delight to welcome to Flight to Classics Parliamentary Representative of Christchurch East Central and Minister in the Ministry of Finance, Ryan Strawn. Good afternoon, Ryan. I appreciate you taking the time out to visit us this afternoon. Thank you so much for coming.
Good afternoon, Philip. Good afternoon, Malcolm. Good afternoon to your listeners. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Now, Ryan, first, on behalf of all Barbadians, I'd like to salute your outstanding service to our nation over the years and by extension for the presentation of this year's financial statements and budgetary proposals. People are still talking about it in different ways, but that is the society in which we live. I would say well done. Now, I want to bring your attention to something because the very first time I ever saw you was on Sunday, March the 25th. I remember that day vividly. It was at the Tower of Power Global Network Ministries Anniversary Crusade held on the Wharton Play Field in Christchurch. You know, and it was a time, I was at the time playing bass in the worship band at that church. I remember Pastor Mark White, leader of that ministry, introducing you to the congregation as the Barbados Labour Party's candidate for Christchurch East Central, after which he began to prophesy on you. I have to say, though, I marveled by the fact that his prophecy in relation to your becoming one of our nation's financial leaders has come into manifestation wonderfully. What is your recall of that day?
Well, I remember it very well because the tent was pitched on the pastor, mm-hmm. and it really was a crusade really to help. At the time, as you would recall, the country was not mentally, if you like, in good shape.
Right.
And on that particular morning, I felt the service was certainly well received by the residents of Wharton. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it immensely. And I think as Pastor White, when I reflected on what he said that morning, mm-hmm. and what I have seen in the last 7 years,
yeah.
I can say that his words ring true, mm-hmm. in relation to certainly what was required to lift the country from that period till now. And it just speaks to the fact that you really have to focus in life, I think, on getting the basics right in order to make sure that you can do things differently for people. And I think that day, certainly I felt particularly blessed. Mm-hmm. I've been to many services. Mm-hmm. But I think on that particular day, given the atmosphere, and music also helps in changing people's perspectives, no matter what may be happening in their lives at any point in time. And I think it's something that we can all hold on to, particularly as life's challenges come our way.
Now, I read that you received your secondary education at Cumbermere School, which in fact is renowned for having produced a rich legacy of outstanding Barbadian financial services professionals. Now, standing beside you is Mark Hill, CEO of First Caribbean, Terrell Cummins, who has had and illustrious career as an investment banker, Warwick Ward, CEO of Financial Services Commission, and Kirk Tate, head of the Financial Intelligence Unit. And of course, George Thomas, who was here a few weeks ago, he is now CEO of Sagicorp Bank. Did you hang out with any of those guys back at school, though? That I mentioned?
Well, coincidentally, Warwick was my form prefect when I was at school. George and Kirk are a little older than I am. But I think I've interfaced with all of them, certainly in the last 7 years, in one form or fashion. I think the truth is that if you think of life as a relay race, I think that you have to always try to pass the baton to the next generation. And I think that based on the names that you just called there, I know each of them very well. Mm-hmm. And we've all been able to make a difference, certainly within our spheres of influence. And all I can say to Barbadians is that you have to look to build that capacity and make sure that the future is in good hands. Now, as Calmarians, and I know half of Barbados out there is troops in right now. and it's all I can say is that what we do as a fraternity really is to try to instill in every Bajan, really, try to show every Bajan that no matter where you go, that it isn't where you went to school, but it is really about what contribution you can make to Barbados and certainly to the rest of the world. And I think that's the message that we want to share. On that, but up and on nevertheless, up and on.
And to your point, what are some of the invaluable life lessons you've learned from being a student of Common Mayor that have essentially become the shoulders upon which you stand throughout your career in public service?
Well, being at Common Mayor, I was a cadet for all the time I was at school. And the one thing I would say, not just in the cadetting, but the circumstances, because I went to Cormier in 1987, and at that time we were transitioning, the country was transitioning, not just from the change in 11+ at the time, but you were seeing technologies being introduced and the like, people's homes were being enhanced, moving from chattel houses to wall houses and a whole set of things. But I think the ethos that I learned from at Cormier was that you really must look out for each other. And that is the spirit within which I think is the one thing that I know from school. We all come from humble beginnings. Yeah. And no matter what you do, where you go, you remain solid friends as a result of that. And I think whenever I hang out with my friends, I'm just Shabba.
Shabba.
And that brings you back to
places you've been before
to reality, quote unquote, because you need strong bonds of friendship that will stay with you in life, that will keep you grounded. And I think that that is one of the things that I would say I hold dear, because I've managed to get a circle of friends that they trust me, I absolutely trust them, and I think that's something that I hold very dearly.
Now, there were several different moods and emotions during your budget presentation that resonated with a whole lot of people. But I have to let you know that I was totally delighted, and I suppose many of those who saw you on television were, to hear you speak candidly about your emergence from humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. I thought that was totally awesome. I laud you for being real, as it really was a sobering reminder of my own experience in this regard. And it is fitting that I say to those out there within the sound of my voice that are hesitant, perhaps, to speak about from whence they came, that coming from desperate struggles isn't necessarily a negative thing, as it oftentimes propels you to incredible places of economic and social emancipation if you work hard, as you have, and remain focused. But having said that, you were raised in 4th Avenue, Long Gap, and 5th Avenue, Perkins Land, respectively. What was your childhood days like, and how would you describe your upbringing, Ryan?
Well, my grandmother raised me. Mm-hmm. So first of all, in the Long Gap, and then in Peterkin. And the one thing I always remember was that We lived in a three-bedroom house in Long Gap. But my grandmother was always able to help others. So I do not remember a time where we did not have families living with us. People fell on hard times. And I remember my grandmother always being there for people. And so that is the thing that I hold very dear, because whilst my grandmother left school at 14 at the time, you know, there was very little education opportunity. I do believe, and I've said this more than one occasion, she's probably one of the brightest people that I know, given what I know now in terms of what she was able to do whilst I was growing up. We had a plot of land next to the house. My grandma had everything inside there. I used to take out sheep before school. So if anybody knows Long Gap now, there's pillars off is what the development is doing now. Before all those houses were there, I used to take out the sheep on mornings. And when they come back from school, you bring them in. We had chickens. We had a couple of goat. And we were able to craft a lifestyle that meant that we only had to go to the shop, Dick shop or Hammy shop on the main road Long Gap, only for rice and those types of things. But you could feed yourself. And I think that level of self-sufficiency is what I remember most about my grandmother's ability to really stretch a dollar. And I take that, I suppose that was training me, if you like, for how to make decisions in the future. Certainly, when we moved to Peterkin in Bank Hall, slightly different circumstances, more urban, if you like, because by that time it was 1992 or 93. So as I mentioned before, things had developed, but it was more urban Barbados than in Long Gap at the time. And so a different kind of experience in terms of community. And I think those were some making different friends. I always had family close in Water Highland, just across the way. So really, just a function of managing to create friends in a different space, which I think most Bajans can understand when families move from place to place. But close to Empire Cricket Ground, so lots of cricket taking place. More formally in Long Gap, we should just play cricket in the road with anything that was available. And so I certainly got to experience a different side of Barbados by going to Empire Cricket Ground, seeing the cricketers, watching the cricketers there on evenings, even though you're supposed to be home doing homework and that kind of thing. But the point is, you got to immerse yourself in a different experience in relation to urban Barbados. So, but my grandmother was very big on education, extremely big on education. And I always remember, certainly at primary school, she would always be there to check my homework. And she made sure that your reading was strong. She knew your vocabulary very well. And she really was the foundation, I think, for my growing up.
Now, you keep mentioning your grandmother. Where was your mother and father?
Well, my mother at the time was... my mother at the time was living elsewhere.
You're right.
And my father lived in St. James. So we would visit. But my grandmother had me from very young. My mother had me when I was 16. And so my grandmother felt it was important that she raised me and make sure that I stayed on the straight and narrow, so to speak. And I think That's Barbados how it is, because when you think of how families evolve without a lot of grandmothers in our lives, I'm sure a lot of us wouldn't quite be sure where we would be today. And I think that's just the essence of Barbados today, and even at the time. So I would visit my mother and father. They would visit me, but my grandmother was the solid rock.
Against all you just mentioned, to what extent has today's Ryan Strong been the beneficiary of those experiences of yesterday that you just spoke about?
Well, I can tell you, my grandmother always used to tell me, I will give you this quick example. Whenever we had to go to town, my grandmother would make sure that we ate before we left home. because when you go down, there was nothing. So you see Chefette and you see you see KFC and these types of things, and she would say, you've had something to eat, you will eat when you get back home. Now, I raised that point to make this that we always have to make choices in life. And therefore, she taught me that there are times when you have to do it out until you can deliver. And that was the one thing that my grandmother was able to instill in me. So over the last 7 years in government, we've had to make some choices. Some things I certainly would have loved to have seen happen sooner than later, but the reality is that it's the same principle
that applies
in relation to the choices that you make, the timing of those choices in relation to what happens. And I think that grounding that I take from my grandmother, I think I've been able to apply. My colleagues may not always like me for it, but the reality is that I think we've been able to show that you can do stuff, but it's the timing of the choices that make sense.
Now, Ryan, it really was interesting to learn that your first job in 1989 was at JG's Wholesale on Portland Street as a checkout boy.
As a checkout boy.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. And your second was in 1994 as a merchandiser at Budge Buy Supermarket BlackRock. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as we speak, there are young Barbadians in the same jobs as you were in 89 and 94 who I'm afraid are suspended within the walls of believing that life has absolutely nothing better to offer. What advice would you give to them?
Well, I remember it was Christmas of 1989. I remember it was $125 a week actually at that time, which for a third farmer is a lot of money. So I used to take the money home, give my grandmother $100.
Wow.
Keep 25. Later on when I was in lower six or upper six, I think, I would leave school on Thursdays after band practice, the Carmere band. I would go home, get some rest. I would pack from 10 p.m. on Black Rock till 6 a.m. in the morning, go to school, because the Friday rush, the Friday demand, and then come back on Friday nights and pack until Saturday morning for the Saturday shopping that people do. So I did that Thursdays and Friday nights for about two terms. And I would say to Barbadians that you have to recognize that you're not always going to, you can't start at the end. Is the long and short of it. But you got to understand how commerce and enterprise work. So therefore in that setting you understand demand and supply. So you're either taking out stuff for people and you get some tips. If you provide good service, you get a decent tip. Sometimes you provide good service, there is no tip. But the point is you have to take the good with the bad. But you give yourself the best chance of learning life. And I think that when I think back as to those days, it really is just a young person getting an opportunity to understand the world.
Yeah.
In that environment. And trust me, there were some people with some very robust language at times, which is part of part of life. But if people want to grow, then you do not look on any particular job as beneath you or anything. And I think in order to change your circumstance, you must invest in yourself and always be open to listening to people around you. And so I started there. I'm here. This is not where I will stay.
Absolutely.
Because life is a continuum. So I think you have to constantly be looking for ways to be able to improve.
Now, to what extent, though, does our modernization and our socialization change that narrative? Because young people now, they want it now. They want the latest cell phones. They want it now, quite frankly, because that's what they're seeing in social media. How would you respond to that?
Let me give you a quick thing. I remember when, you may remember when Reefs were the fashionable thing. And I remember at that time you couldn't afford no Reefs, but me and some friends of mine, we played record at school. So we used to go, we went down to West Terrace and Husbands and like certain middle class areas in Barbados at Christmas time, and we played Christmas carols for people. People mm-hmm. gave us lots of ham and turkey and stuff, but they also gave us some money. Right. And at the end of that exercise, we were able to go down to Cave Shepherd at the time and buy, each of us were able to buy a pair of reefs. Now, what's the lesson? You have a talent, mm-hmm. you apply that talent, you will achieve the result in the time frame that you set, but you have to be able to invest the discipline in order to understand that if you want something, you have to work for that something. And I think that if we all learn that and learn it well, then you understand what you can provide for the world. So it's just a matter of using talents that you do have to be able to do that. So the idea of that you want something, no. I mean, unless you have an inheritance or access to ready cash, you really have to find a way to work for what you want.
Yeah, well said. Now, you are a man of many different dimensions. Based on my research, you have this underlying love for music, which I'm told, emanated from the oldie goldies, those 78 and 32 records your grandmother played in the house, you know, while you were growing up. Now, your involvement with the Wesley Hall Oratorical Society and the Cumbermere Cadet as well underscore this. But I want to talk about your performance as a member of the Barbados Defence Force Band in Edinburgh, Scotland. 1995, was it?
1999.
What was that like, though?
We spent, that was my first trip to England.
Right.
We spent 5 weeks in Scotland and then a week in London. But that was a phenomenal experience. As a matter of fact, I think during the pandemic, I had posted a video of it that I'd found somewhere on the internet. But really and truly, I mean, I was 23 at the time, playing my clarinet with the rest of the members of the Defence Force Band. A group of very talented musicians, very disciplined, as soldiers must be. And
so you were a soldier?
Yeah, I was part of the regiment. No, when I left school, because I wanted to continue playing. So the natural thing was to join the Defence Force Band. I did do some training and all of that, but music really was the purpose for me joining the Defence Force. And that was, again, in terms of experience. So the discipline of, quote unquote, being a soldier. I mean, it was a cadet, so it's not new, but you were able then to do something that I don't think I would have been able to do otherwise. And that trip to Edinburgh was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience. I think we were able to represent Barbados and Barbadian culture extremely well for the 4 weeks that we were there, every night doing the displays and the tattoo. And the audiences, every night we finish, they were on their feet with applause.
Wanting more.
And I think it is something that if people care to, you just Google it on my YouTube channel and see. It's a wonderful experience. And I hope that those are the kinds of things that may not only be music, but whatever young people want to get involved with can really represent the country well. And I think any opportunity that they can do so, they should grab.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, Ryan, I suppose many passengers on this flight would be unaware that you have actually been a school teacher. You know what I'm saying? I did. Captain Forrester didn't know.
Oh,
so
boy.
The inferences, a lot of our passengers didn't know as well. You taught physics, chemistry as well, and music at Louis Lynch before teaching music at Springer in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
How would you reflect on that journey?
Actually, quite recently, a friend of mine, her mom passed, and I tell this story because it's kind of instructive. So when I left Cumbermere, at the time, I got a 3 in English A, which meant that I could not naturally matriculate to university. So I had all the other subjects except English A. So I was home one day, and because everybody else had gone to university, and Miss Branch, she came to my house. She asked me what I was doing. I said, well, why am I not at university? So I explained to her about the English and what have you. So she said to me, don't worry. Went into town. She walked. This lady used to walk everywhere. She walked into town, down to Cloister's bookstore, bought me a workbook, and said, you're going to do this exam in January in order to make sure you can go to university. Now, long story short, in terms of being able to pay for it, because I did physics and chemistry, she was able to get me an opportunity at Louis Lynch to do physics and chemistry in order to finance, because the teacher was traveling for 2 months. So I was able to slot in there to teach this physics and chemistry for 2 months. So I hope that I didn't do much harm at the time, but I was able to again use what you have in order to achieve the goal. So that's how I got to teach physics and chemistry that first. So that was my first teaching job, quote unquote. The music at Springer, and then the following year, the music at Louis Lynch. I also taught at Hillary Turner's Hall too, in that period of time. And that was quite a phenomenal experience, because teaching at primary school is very different from teaching at secondary school. And certainly teaching at Springer, very different from teaching in a co-ed scenario like at Louis Lynch. And all of that, I think I was prepared for, because as a cadet, as you rose in the ranks, you were able to deal with people and motivate people and be able to hone the skill. But of course, it still requires application. So that was a very interesting time whilst I was at eventually got to university. And so I like teaching. I subsequently then lectured after graduating from university, both at undergraduate and master's level as well. But teaching has always been a part of what I love to do.
That's awesome. Indeed. Now, I read that you began your financial career at the Central Bank in 2000. Mm-hmm. My question is, to what extent had this myriad, and you heard the word myriad, of acquired experience working in various areas across the professional divide in Barbados informed your better understanding of what you wanted to bring to public life? Because, I mean, I'm thinking, with so much experience in different places, working in different places, in different areas of employment, there has to be now a way of thinking, listen, this is what I want to be when I get into public life. How did it all make it work for you?
Well, the way I would answer that question is that I wanted to be a composer/conductor, musically.
Right.
And so by the time I remember speaking with my guidance counselor about university, actually, and so I'm going to ask you a question, but we'll get there. And at the time, because we couldn't find any scholarships to do music, and the program at BCC had only started 3 years later in 1998, I had to pick a course. So I ended up doing economics and mathematics. So having worked at the Central Bank, when I was there, part of my responsibility was modeling the Barbados economy. So then I realized, well, when I'm looking at all the different sets of data, the different industries, the different sectors, I see myself now as a conductor.
Despite the fact that you were doing numbers.
So the skill of pulling together an ensemble is no different from the skill of conducting an economy.
Mm.
And so if you understand when the trumpet's supposed to play, when the sax is supposed to play, when the rhythm is supposed to increase in speed, when you're supposed to get loud or soft, the economy is really a fluid organism, if you like, that is like music. And I think that I've been able to utilize those skills, but now at a much bigger scale, quote unquote. It's not bigger, but on a different scale, to do things that are a little differently. And I think that I cherish the time at the Central Bank, because that's where I tell people all the time, that's where I learned the Barbados economy in terms of financially, the numbers, and the interactions then that I've been able to have with the private sector before I got into politics. helped me to further deepen that understanding as to who are the players now.
Yep.
So if you imagine yourself as an audience, you're hearing the music. The conductor knows the players, the ability of those players, and therefore can tease out from those players what it is that you're hearing. So I think what Barbadians are seeing and feeling today is as a result of that.
Years and years of
expression
yeah.
as to how to conduct the Barbados economy.
No. Now let's talk some more about your rather impressive academic profile, if we may. Now, why economics and finance as opposed to something else?
But as I said, at the time of applying, there was really, when I looked at the university application, of all the things that were listed, I was always good at maths. So I said, okay, I don't only want to do maths. So I saw that there was this option for economics and mathematics. If there was a music option, I would have done music, but there wasn't. So it turns out pretty good at this thing. and so you read, you discuss amongst your peers, you do your research, you gain some knowledge, but there's always something that you need to, whatever you think you know, there's always something that you don't know, and you must always be on your guard, so to speak, for this
new knowledge,
this thing to manifest itself in some way. And so I think as an economist, really and truly, that is where, when we talk about confidence, it comes down to the fact that I know that I can trust the players in the orchestra to give me the sound that I want at any given time. But I know that if somebody's not available or not up to full speed, I can still produce the sound, but I have to adjust either the volume of what's happening in the orchestra to make sure the song remains as you want it. So the economy is similar in that respect. So I think that it is the choice of that just came naturally because of the strength in mathematics. And the truth is, life is maths, whether we like it or not. And inherently, if you're good at maths, you can get pretty sophisticated. You can keep it very simple for people to understand and appreciate. And I think that we've been able to do a bit of both, because there's life is complex, and therefore you have to be able to apply your knowledge in circumstances as it arises.
Well explained. Now, Ryan, I'm curious to know about your transitioning into those two university overseas, universities overseas that I made mention of earlier. How would you describe the challenges in so doing, especially as it relates to the University of Manchester?
Okay. Manchester was my postgraduate. I did econometrics, which is perhaps the most mathematical form of economics. And it's easiest way I can explain it to your listeners. And so...
Passengers, not listeners.
But sorry, your passengers. Your passengers. Thank you. Yes, of course, your passengers. And the reality is that you can give me any set of data, I can measure and tell you exactly what's happened. That's the skill that provides you. So there's no guesswork, there's no gut feeling, there's no anything. This is what the data says. You link the relations and they can give you chapter and verse as to how a business is operating, whether it's bleeding cash, whether it's growing, whatever it is. And the same is obviously then for the economy in relation to how it works. So that is what I did at University of Manchester. And it has served me well, I think, certainly when I came back then to the Central Bank after that year, immersed myself further in the model development of the country. And I think that has been a key intervention, I would say, in terms of my work that I was doing privately as a consultant before getting into politics. And it certainly has been helpful now, even though it's not my job, but because I know instinctively what should happen we can craft the right policies then to make things happen in the way that we would like. So that's, I would say that, that's my takeaway from the University of Manchester.
I want to raise one last item with you before we get back to some classics. Now, I've spoken here on a number of occasions about the sacrifices that are made, parents make in particular, to give their children a shot. Obviously, you mentioned Manchester University. There was a financial cost that has to come from somewhere. It has to be footed by somewhere. I know that some parents sacrifice, refinance their properties, they surrender insurance policies, they abort the idea, of a much needed vacation. Can you think, can you recall sacrifices that you have made personally or have been made in your behalf to give you this abundance of education that you have?
So I remember at the time I had applied for a Achieving in Scholarship, and which is administered by the British High Commission. And it was not successful, but it just so happened that that year the Lord Mayor of London was visiting. The Lord Mayor of London was visiting in 2001, and the High Commission recommended me to get a scholarship. It only covered my tuition, right? Which was good. I was very grateful because that was one headache that I didn't have to worry about. And so I applied to the Student Revolving Loan Fund, and two of my very good friends, at the time stood surety for me. Right? One is, and coincidentally, both of them work in the Ministry of Education today. They weren't then, but today. And I always thank them for that opportunity because, you know, oftentimes with student revolving loans, as has been said in the past, people go and study and then don't pay it back, and then the sureties have to things. And I always reflect on the fact that they trusted me to not just finish the degree, but to pay back. And I remember very well at the time when I came back, because normally with a student loan, you have a 1 year grace period after you finish before you are required to repay. And I remember I came back, I started back working, and I was able to pay off that loan exactly on that 1 year mark that released both my friends from the obligation of having to be called upon. So it's not as if it wasn't going to pay, because it meant that when they did the calculation, this is something that your listeners might wish to hear.
Passengers.
Sorry, your passengers.
Keep that in mind.
Sorry, my apologies. Your passengers.
Yeah.
Because when they worked out the interest that I would have to pay over 12 years versus the sacrifice that if I played it off in the 9 months that I did, it was significantly a huge difference.
Yeah.
And so I remember I had borrowed $20,000. And the interest would have been like $15,000 over the 12 years.
$35,000.
And I said, you know what? I'm not prepared to have this thing on me for this length of time. So I remember I was working at Central Bank. I was also tutoring at the university, and I was able to then work my finances to make sure that within the 9 months before the compound interest started, I was able to repay that, paid probably, so the student revolving loan probably not like me saying this, because they didn't really make a lot of money off of me on that transaction.
Yeah.
But I felt very proud at that time that my friends did not have to worry
as to whether or not.
I still have the letter at home. I actually have it on my phone too. I save it in my thing. But I have it on my phone that says, "Dear, just for the purpose of discussion, dear Philip, dear Malcolm, Ryan Strong has repaid his student loan. Everything is settled," and I have that there just as a reminder that discipline.
But discipline now that you're saying that. To your point, I have been in a similar situation, rather, standing for, good afternoon, Martine, Chase, and her mother, Ingrid.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the same way when the letter came that Martine had paid everything.
When people trust you,
yeah,
you have to make sure that
awesome
as you've been.
So Ryan, we're having the most interesting conversation, and more heat is to come, because when we come back, we want to talk about another dimension of you that's interesting. That's your political career. All right. Mm. So let's play some music here on the Beat 104.
She's like, yo, these two guys, y'all, my sleep, I feel it, putting on my roller blades.
Well, that's a good
sorry,
thing.
My roller skates. My roller skates, oh, yeah. She said. How we bring about. Yeah. Rosemary! How you doing, Rosemary? Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, thanks, Rosemary.
This flight is made possible by, of course, 4Play Deli in Sheraton Mall. Yeah. Where they roll the rotis
right in front of you. Yeah, man.
Guyanese cuisine at its best.
4Play Deli's got it.
We've got that taste you won't forget.
4Play Deli.
Oh, how we aim to please ya. We wrap the rotis in front of ya. Great service with a smile. Got your taste buds going wild. Rice and beef, salt, fish, chicken, lamb, and doubles on the list.
Deli.
You just can't refuse it at 4Play Deli. Taste you won't forget.
4Play Deli, located in Sheraton Mall.
The Beat 104.1 FM, where FM means your favorite music.
Oh, you like a lot. Once again, I want to thank all of the constituents of 4Play Deli Sheraton Mall. You know what I'm saying? The legacy of our business stands on your support. And I'm in the presence of an economist, but I'm going to say here that despite the fact that there has been acute inflation, we have for some reason found a way of keeping our prices within the pockets of your affordability. Because the economic law, quite frankly, is to pass it on to the final consumer. But we have to consider, what is the final consumer making? And to what extent do we make ourselves extinct, you know what I'm saying, from the marketplace, if we overcharge the people, if we go out of their pocket? But anyway, I want to thank you very much indeed. And by the way, though, I'd like you to take advantage of our call to collect service, which essentially means that if you call us like 10 minutes before, when you get there, your order will be ready. Time is money. And traffic is serious in Barbados, man. So 4Play Deli, give us a call at 845-1428-537-0299. As you are aware, and as you now know, we are in the center of the most intriguing conversation with a very interesting man. Ryan, I want to speak to your political career right now. Political career, yeah? You know, I have to say, though, there has always been this inextricable connection between law and politics, as many lawyers right across the Caribbean, quite frankly, have become career politicians. The same can be said for economists. Former Prime Minister, the late Owen Arthur, had been one of the Caribbean's most revered economists. And that's the truth. Agreed. But yeah. Ryan, yeah, but you got into politics, though, in one of the most unusual of ways. Please explain.
Okay, so I moved back from England in 2010. And at the end of 2010. And at that time, even though we knew that there were some headwinds, my wife and I, because my wife also worked at the central bank as well, we were in no doubt that the country was going to right-size itself quickly. So we moved home full of, you know, hope and everything. Started the business. And I'm doing my work. Mm-hmm. And I was the president of the Economic Society. So as things were evolving away from equilibrium, let me put it that way, going off track. Obviously, I was making commentary about what needed to be done and all of that. More from a perspective of sensitizing the public more so than anything else, because I'm an economist. Now, I had at that time had a few conversations with the then leader of the opposition, not the prime minister, And I really had no interest in politics or anything. I was happy to grow my business. But then in 2013, the government introduced tuition fees at the university. And that was the spark, if you like, because I understood then as a boy from Bank Hall and Long Gap, that if somebody didn't pay for me to go to university, there was no way that I was going to be successful in growing my business and what I was doing. And therefore, you needed to make sure that that continuity was there. Remember I said earlier, you got to pass the baton to somebody after you've run your leg. So I felt very strongly that that had to be reversed. And I remember calling the Prime Minister, leader of the opposition at the time, the next day, and he said, I will do whatever I have to do to fix this. And so that's how, I don't think that if that didn't happen that I would be here. Mm-hmm. Because that is, as I told you, my grandmother believed in education. Because she wasn't able to have it, leaving school at 14 at the time, as most of our grandparents didn't have any opportunity back then. I felt it was important to make that right. And therefore, it that is really the reason why, the main reason that I am involved in politics is really to repair that damage.
So suffice to say, it was more of a revolt. A revolt, that's the word you use?
Revolt, it was unnecessary because I recall specifically the year before, a group of us had met to look at different options because there was some talk about this thing happening before. And we met with the minister at the time. We presented the proposals to avoid the introduction of fees because the reality is that you may assume something about people, but the capacity to pay when they're not prepared for something and could be significant. It has been significant in terms of now that is what, this is now 12 years since that decision, and even though you may have heard either, I think yesterday in yesterday's news, the university is saying that obviously with the enrollment still down, they've had to look externally for more students to come in. And the reality is that it has an impact on the business of the university, but more importantly, it has an impact on the skills that the country needs
for the future,
even
right?
today. So yeah. The decision 12 years ago meant that the enrollment dropped, which means that the people that would have been ordinarily coming out and gaining experience in the system. So Barbados is now faced with a skills gap because you don't have enough people coming up now to be able to deal with that. So without getting into all the details, the reality is that that was a poor decision and it will have a long-lasting impact on the country, which is why we've been trying to close the gap by doing more and more training and that kind of thing. You see now there's a dedicated training ministry to be able to help ramp it up. COVID kind of disrupted the part of that plan. And so Barbados needs to upskill. So no matter what job you're in, I mean, Malcolm, you remember the days when you had the milk cartons?
Yes, very much so.
The milk cartons as a DJ.
Very heavy.
You understand?
Yeah.
Now, could you imagine in today's world
still having that?
You having those milk cartons as a DJ?
No.
Things have changed within your industry.
Yeah.
And I'm saying to Barbadians that we have to trust in our skill to understand that we need to upskill and build on what we have in order to continue to remain, not just remain relevant, but thrive in this world. And therefore, no matter what profession you are in today, you have to find a way to up the game.
Yeah.
Have to find a way.
To remain relevant.
Have to find a way.
Now, let's get some more into your political journey. You contested and won the Christchurch East Central seat in 2018. Now, would you consider that victory to be sort of a watershed moment of your life?
Well,
one of them.
Well, yes. I remember I virtually visited every house in the constituency. Took fully 2 years to do, and obviously not that doesn't mean you've met everybody, but try to visit every house and listen to people. And I think the victory in of itself was not only in part to do with the fact that I visited the homes. I think people genuinely wanted to have any country across the country genuinely wanted to see the country move in a different direction. I think Barbadians instinctively know when they are being well led. Now, that may manifest itself in different ways because people may not like a particular personality or what have you, but I think Barbadians genuinely know when that's the case. And I think as the what I will tell you the impact that it's had, because I used to, before that, I would pick up my son from school at about 2:30. I would, and between 2:30 and 6 o'clock, 6:30, that was our time. Until his mother got home from work, because I would arrange my day, start at 7, finish at 2, to be able to do that. And so that victory has had the complete opposite impact on the personal life, because it means that I take him to school on mornings. I'm never really sure when my day will finish because all types of things are happening. So it's been a watershed for several reasons, because the sacrifices that you have to make within your family life, and he's autistic, so that's an additional challenge. And so sacrifices are part of anybody who's going to volunteer for
public life,
public service.
Mm-hmm. Now, and you know, I was going to mention that though, before you raised the point, because I wanted to know to what extent has parliamentary representation, ministerial demands, yeah, and family commitments tested your forbearance?
Well, it has not been easy. I mean, my wife understands why we needed to rescue the country. But as things have gotten more intense, especially during COVID, COVID was particularly challenging because even though I was at home, I really wasn't at home. And there was this particular time when I was in my office on Zoom. I came out to get something to drink and my son pushed me back into the office. And I was like, whoa. And it was in that moment I realized I had to create a cutoff between work
and him
and being at home. Because even though we were all home, I was at work. And therefore, I immediately just cut that at 4:30, 5 o'clock, and made sure then that you were able to spend time, because it was a crazy time. It was a completely crazy time. But the reality is that it's not been easy. Certainly, every year in October, my anniversary is October 14th. Every year during that time, I've been away at annual meetings in Washington or somewhere with the IMF World Bank meetings. This year is going to be 20 years. I will not be attending annual meetings this year because of our 20th anniversary of marriage. So,
congratulations.
So, thank you. So I will not be attending this year. But those are things that because of the job that you've had to kind of make work, given the commitments that you have. But it's not been easy. It's not been easy at all.
And to your point, it was really pleasing to hear you thank your wife and your family for their patience and understanding over the years. That was totally heartwarming for me. But having said that, though, there is an intriguing little romance story between you and her that might be of value to men out there who aren't particularly romantic like myself and Malcolm X. You know. Now, you met your wife at UWI. Ironically, she tutored you statistics. How dare you? How dare you, sir? You know. Studied economics and mathematics. Both of you emerged with first class honors. Congratulations. Now, you worked together at the Barbados Central Bank, and the two of you pursued graduate studies in the UK while you were in Manchester. she studied in Edinburgh. Now listen to this. Now you sent her, you know, lots of love poems, and you even cooked for her, you know. Now you were revered by your friends for being a bad example of distance learning, you know. Come on, Ryan, you are not a nice man, but you're a really good man. So the message of that story, right, the message that story is sending, right, is that a way to a woman's heart are through poems and proper cooked food. How cool is that?
So I always tell my wife, because we were friends, so no, we were genuinely friends. Mm-hmm. So I remember meeting her at university as a student before she graduated. And there was one day when she was tutoring me. I don't remember the subject, but we were in class. We were at Caulfield. And she was showing us something on the board. And I told her, I'm not convinced by what? By her argument. So, of course, she got first class honors. Because the person people who get first class honors, you get to come back and tutor. Mm-hmm. As part of the skills, you know, honing your skills. So I always remember that moment in particular. And a few years after, she did admit to me that on that particular day she wasn't quite sure what she was saying. But that aside, mm-hmm. we were friends, and I remember when we actually traveled on the same airplane, the same flight from Barbados. So I'm there sitting in my seat, sleeping.
Right.
And she comes and wakes me up in the middle. I'm like, I'm sleeping anyhow. So that was September, be going up to thing, and I think something happened over the course of the summer. Mm. A group of us did a trip did a European tour, this Contiki tour. So we went from Amsterdam to Viet to Munich.
What year was that?
That was 2002.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, that was 2002. The Commonwealth Games was held in Manchester. Mm. The Beijing contingent was up there. A friend of mine, I actually was a promoter. I hosted a fete at a local pub, charged £1 for the athletes to come down. So we had a grand night and thing. But that summer was a great summer that we had. And something sparked during that time. So, but we've been friends now. This is 20, almost 30 years. Mm. We've been friends, and we remain friends to this day.
You know, and that is so important because today's world evidently does not lend to that, because it's all about what family you come from, the job that you have. And in some cases, the kind of cell phone you have, the car. And funny enough, I was driving through the other day. Was it St. George? And there was a junkyard there, with lots of cars.
Yeah.
And it came into my spirit. How many relationships were formed in that car? You know? So the story is, when the car falls apart, would you still love me? When I don't have the job, would you still love me? And I think that the message is you just send without even realizing it, the bond of friendship is important to the longevity of any relationship. 30 years, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I want to turn our attention to probably the most serious part of our conversation, and that's the budget and financial statements you presented last week. Now, in so doing, I'd like to say it is quite frankly the nature of some Barbadians to be skeptical of change. So therefore, this paradigm shift we've just witnessed with respect to who presented the budget this year would have understandably evoked the kind of conjecture and speculation, the extent to which it did. But having said that, Ryan, walk me through, if you will, the communication process from the Prime Minister to you with respect to your presentation of the 2025 financial statements and budgetary proposals.
Okay, so probably from earlier this year, if not before, I mean, the Prime Minister has been signaling that she wants to fire herself, quote unquote. But I think in sometime in February, she said to me, you know, I think you're going to do the budget. But that was just conversation in relation to where we go. Because the process starts very early in relation to the preparation. So for the last 7 years, as we gather, looking at the policies, what the priorities that we're going to do, and they just start writing. So I recall about, could have been 2.5 weeks ago now, we were having a conversation. She said to me, you're going to do the budget. So I was like, okay, thank you. And just continued with respect to the preparation as we would normally mm-hmm, do. Mm-hmm. Now, the reality is that I think instinctively I knew that at some point it will happen. And so I really didn't skip a beat, so to speak, because having been immersed in policy formulation over the last 7 years, what I think Barbadians saw on Monday was really just the discipline and the preparation that you would expect from someone who has been in the mix, in the thick of things. And I really do thank the Prime Minister for the opportunity to do it, because I think to her point about showing the country that, again, you're investing in continuity is important, because the Barbados that we know really has been about building capacity for the future. And I think that that is something that, irrespective of what may lie ahead, the country needs to be assured that there are people who can deliver.
Now, Ryan, one day, when you write your memoir, I suppose you'll mention the historic significance of Monday, March 10th, 2025, and how it's been for you. But I want to ask you, though, how would you describe the state of your emotions, let's say 15 minutes before the presentation began? Were you desperately nervous? Were you anxious, excited? What was it like?
Well, so I knew what I needed to do. So having written the text, coming through the yard of Parliament, and obviously the crowd is there and the press and all of that, that was new. Because before, that would have been the Prime Minister doing that part of it and answering the questions in that way. And so I felt comfortable.
Okay.
I felt comfortable knowing that this is happening and that I was in control of the situation. When I walked upstairs to the cabinet colleagues, and I walked into the room, and everybody was looking at me. So it was then that I realized, oh boy.
This is it. Yeah.
And so we finished the meeting, walked over to the chamber. I took my seat, and all that time I'm watching people come into the gallery and all of that, which is something that I wouldn't normally do, because I come to do a debate, mm-hmm. But obviously, of course, this is the budget. Mm-hmm. So nervous,
perhaps.
It was more being very confident that, having done the work, I just needed to show the country that the future is bright. And I think that I was, when I began the speech, all of whatever nervous tension that may have been,
it began
there,
to dissipate. Obviously.
It just faded and faded very quickly.
Now, Ryan, this 2025 budget is a 174-page document. Now, I'm curious to know, and so are many Barbadians, how does government set about identifying the many fiscal policies it wishes to promote? And indeed, who are some of the other players involved with structuring this expansive financial instrument?
So we have a team of people at the ministry and a support team that helps with input. Sometime in January, we sent out, as we do normally, sent out correspondence to all of the stakeholders to, you know, ask for them to write in the things that they think of importance to the particular sector of industry. You know, we match that with trying to cost what each ax would mean and how you would prioritize that. Equally, ministers and ministries may have things of priority that they wish to have highlighted as part of the process. And because we had 3 weeks of public explanation with ministries in the well of parliament explaining what the program was for the coming year. So I took the opportunity to highlight some of those areas that were not addressed in the well of parliament to be able to bring to the fore. Now, the truth is that the only reason it was 174 pages is because it was double space, so you can read. so that I can read the thing. Yeah.
Just like this here.
Precisely. So, but the reality is that there's so much that could have been said that I didn't say, and that doesn't mean that they're any less of a priority. It is just that for the time, I mean, I could have spoken for 10 hours.
Oh Lord.
I could have.
Yeah.
But that would have defeated the purpose of trying to elevate the things that you wanted to leave in people's minds in relation to the budget. So, but as we go through the year, we give, you know, different statements, we bring legislation and those types of things, which is really the government implementing. And so we try to rank, if you like, the things that would be most powerful is not quite the word, but the most impactful, given the myriad of things that people have asked for. If things are going to cost too much, it is paused until you get further examination as to exactly how that will play out. And the balance between certainly raising revenue versus
expenditure.
And then we think of financing as part of that is really where a lot of attention is paid, because if you can't pay for it, whatever it is, then it's not going to happen. And therefore, part of what we do is, as far as possible, try to make sure that we understand how something is going to be paid for, even though you may not have 100% of the information available to you now. The priorities may require that it is done. And therefore, you have to balance all of those competing factors. And I think back to my grandmother all the time in that respect. You do what you know you must. And those things that you could do without for the time being,
leave them alone.
You leave them out.
Now, Ryan, as you are aware, all of us are, budgetary proposals have always received mixed reviews from Barbadians. I suppose largely because of the polarized society in which we live. But I want to ask you, though, what has been the response from business leaders in Barbados? And more importantly, what are you hearing from the voices of your constituents in Christchurch East Central?
Well, I have had several, and I must admit, I haven't been able to respond to every single message, but I really want to thank Barbadians for reaching out to me via my WhatsApp to offer congratulations and genuine feedback on not just the presentation but the content of the budget. I've had some very good feedback from a range of business leaders, from my constituents similarly, in relation to them seeing me feeling proud to know that as their member of parliament, that I was able to deliver a solid budget. So a few questions on, you know, clarifying a few things, which is normal, par for the course. And I think I've had from people around the region and internationally as well. And I think the truth is that it is perhaps the first budget in a while that a whole set of the population don't feel aggrieved. And I say a while meaning people have grown accustomed to taxes being adjusted every year. That has not been the case under this administration. And I think as we now move from what was mission critical, mission survival during COVID, we've recovered, now we entered a different phase. I hope and pray that notwithstanding all that's been happening globally, that these are the kinds of budgets that people can get accustomed to going forward, that yes, you will see some adjustments here and there with respect to things, but you're seeing it in the interest of the country as opposed to the government being out of sync with its mandate. So, but I think generally speaking, people have been very pleased with the content of the budget.
Now, Ryan, as you are aware, the high cost of living is still a concern for Barbadians, quite frankly.
Yep.
Now, my question is, though, how can Barbados realistically escape the wrath of acute inflation? You know, if it remains a state of reality in other countries of the world that we do business with, the United States, for example, how can we escape that wrath?
Well, there's a lot of work being done right now with Guyana and Suriname in relation to food for the region. And the introduction of climate resilient agricultural techniques is going to be absolutely critical for that. For a whole host of reasons, because is there too much, too little water, too much water, too much sun, pests? Is it too hot? The chickens dying, eggs not. So the things that Barbados is known for, we need to make sure that we do it in a much more climate resilient way, which means that farmers have to start to change some of the things that they're doing. It also means that you're going to have to make some choices, quite frankly, in relation to how you view convenience. Now, as I told you earlier, my grandmother had a little piece of land next to her and everything was in there. So there was no convenience factor. My grandmother made everything pretty much in the house. But if you want to go and purchase stuff that's already processed, that is where the cost buildup is going to be. So the quote unquote, the cost of living is the cost of the choices that we all live. And therefore, I think we have to unpack, if you like, the cost of the convenience versus the cost of preparing a meal. Mm-hmm. And so time is money. You mentioned it earlier in your thing. Time is money. So therefore, if you want to just microwave something or do something very quickly, then there's inherent cost in that. I mean, with all these tariffs and stuff that's swirling about the place now, then you know
what's going to happen.
It's only going to get worse. Mm. Now, we have been working with the private sectors who import stuff to say, look, guys, you have to look for different parts of the world to bring stuff from together. Because if all three of us here importing the same thing go to the market with a different order, we're going to get a different price associated with that. We must pool, place a larger order, get a lower unit cost. So that comes down to us working collaboratively together as business people to do that. It is not easy, but it must be done if we are going to be able to help contain some of the cost that inherently is there. But I think there are some things that you just can't escape. And certainly technology is something that we all have gone accustomed to. However, though, how we use it in our businesses will make a difference as to how we can lower costs and ultimately prices to consumers. Now, of course, some people may adjust their portion sizes. If you're into food, some people have, like, for example, some people, the rotis get smaller. I'm calling the names. Some people, if you will see the leg pipes, there is space in the bag with the leg pipes.
Yeah,
you understand, to try to keep the price the same. But it is thing though. For me personally, I would rather eat a certain size lead pipe, if I was going to eat a lead pipe or a certain size roti. But that's a different subject. The point is that businesses are adopting different strategies to help contain costs. Government is also adopting strategies to help, certainly with respect to the amount of taxes that it collects that is then passed on to consumers. So it's a complex thing. There's no simple, straightforward answer to it, because it genuinely comes down to how you want to live, quote unquote, in this environment. So if you continue with the same taste without recognizing that something, the underlying conditions have changed, then you must be prepared to pay for maintaining that.
So Ryan, I just want to continue with the budget very quickly on these items. There have been quite a few interesting and ingenious, and I use the word ingenious, items in this year's financial statement. I make reference to the solidarity allowance. How did the idea of this initiative come about?
Well, very quickly, when we came to office in 2018, we had to make some adjustments very quickly, which included raising taxes, debt, restructuring, and a whole set of things. Some persons were laid off from the public service, and a range of things that needed to right size. So we, from the very beginning, we always said, if you're going to share the burden, you got to share the bounty in relation to getting stuff done. Then you had COVID, another $1 billion adjustment. So the economy really has been battered, if you like, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic. So when we did the tax reform last in November of 2023, the corporate tax reform with respect to global minimum taxes, and we recognized that the revenues were performing much better than we had initially forecast. And therefore, to remain consistent with that principle that you have shared the burden, everybody in the country, then you have a little quote-unquote surplus, and therefore it was important to show that the government is true to its word in that respect, so that it is not a conversation only about raising taxes or, you know, these things that people have associated with budgets. And so I think that is where the solidarity allowance was conceived, as a mechanism to say to Bajans that thank you very much for remaining faithful with the government with respect to all that's happened, in some domestic, some completely external. We've made it through all of that. The economy is in much better shape, and we have an opportunity that whilst we can't make structural changes at the moment, given all that's happening outside, that this at least we can do as a one-off to show Barbadians that we're in it together.
Is there a proposal out of the many you tabled last Monday that has, in your judgment, resonated resoundingly with Barbadians right across the socioeconomic diaspora? Is there one of them?
Well, I think I'll raise the one on paternity leave. Because, let me say to the fellas up there that paternity leave is not vacation. Yeah, it's not vacation. It is actually quite progressive. I remember when I took paternity leave in 2008, and it was the most extraordinary time because obviously my wife had just given birth, and it is the most vulnerable time because having born a child, a woman now has to nurture the child, and the body has to heal and all of that. And so I say to the fellas, this is not anything that you should take lightly. And so of all the things that I think we've done, that is the one that I think has resonated with people. I mean, a lot has, but I think of in terms of being able to start off on the right foot in terms of building families and building communities, that's been long outstanding in relation to supporting families in a tangible way. And it's something that's been called for some time. And we got the opportunity to do it now, and I was happy to be able to announce that for families in Barbados.
Now, It was interesting to hear you make reference to the state of crime and, yeah. And the extent to which gun crime in particular has become a menace to the Barbadian society now. Tougher legislation is widely perceived to be the antidote. It, however, will appear, though, that the perpetrators of these serious crimes care less about the potential repercussions of their actions. How would you respond to that, Ryan?
Well, I think the numbers will suggest that, given that we've seen a number of people who have committed serious crimes, it is still inexplicable how they've been able to get bail and still recommit. And I think that lack of care for human life is something that's quite
frightening. It's
quite disturbing. So, I mean, we've done a lot to, you'll see that a lot of the cases now are actually being called sooner. And the truth is we would really like that. The government would prefer that people don't kill people. But to the extent that you do, it is really our view that within 6 to 9 months, those cases should be discharged quickly so that the possibility of reoffending doesn't exist, so that it serves as a deterrent. So it's not so much the legislation only, it is really about how do we get the communities, the country, the society to appreciate that we all have skin in the game. And therefore, we must be committed to ensuring then that the systems work in order to hold people to account for these kinds of things. But the truth is, the government can't legislate love.
No, not at all. Yeah, I mean, that's profound what you just said. They can't. But Ryan, you know, we have arrived at the twilight of our conversation. It's therefore against that background, I want to digress into another era of our mm-hmm. conversation that I believe will pique the interest of our passengers in this flight. As you are aware, our world is now in the most precarious state it probably has ever been, quite frankly. Climate change, political instability in the Middle East, the war of attrition involving Russia and Ukraine, and now the trade war that's looming between the United States and some of its global trading partners. Suffice to say, Barbadians are by and large desperately apprehensive at the moment. My question is, how do you see the implications of this trade war for us here in the Caribbean? And how is the Barbados government reposing itself for the realities of acute inflation and even a recession if this trade war between the US and its trading partners become attritional?
Well, since 2018, we've embarked on a very aggressive strategy to expand our markets. And I say that because we've opened a high commission in Ghana and Kenya with the particular purpose of being able to do more business with Africa. And I think that is on its way. We've also expanded within Latin America as well. We have certainly direct flights through Copa, through Panama, and a lot more from Latin America. So to the extent that we have already started discussion with the private sector, but one, where to source alternative goods from, where new investment can come from, whether from Africa or from Latin America, in terms of not just tourists, but also genuine investment, where Barbadians also can invest, is going to be important. And so the fact that it is manifesting itself now as a trade war, in a sense, part of the recovery effort, the Barbados Economic Recovery and Transformation Program, has been to expand or diversify the economy to the extent that where we invest and where we get investment from. And so I think that Barbadians would be wise to more aggressively pursue said opportunities, as well as the regional opportunities as well, because if it's the time for us to get this CARICOM single market and single economy working, it is now. And whether that is Bajans going to work elsewhere or other people coming to work in Barbados or whatever shape or form it takes, we have to do what is required of us to make sure that we don't just survive in this world, but obviously that we have an opportunity to thrive. So The government is very clear that we will continue to open up opportunities for investment at home and abroad. Let me say to Barbadians, please don't fall for these scams that keep coming out all the time, because that's just wasted time and money and effort on everybody's part. Because when people work hard and save their money, I know they want to have genuine investment opportunities. We are laying on those opportunities for people. But it means that businesses have to open up and let people know what are the opportunities that I can invest in for Play Delhi, for example. And therefore, that way we know, we can touch and feel and know what the investment is going into. And it means a change of culture in terms of information. But I think we've been preparing ourselves, not for this particular circumstance, but I think we've been preparing ourselves from the beginning to make sure that we can ride out any storm. Now, I think eventually they will come to their senses, because as you know, whether you cannot go any part of the world, any of these metropolitan cities, they all run on immigration. Oh. All of the restaurants, all of the tourism, all the hospitality, everything runs on immigration, on immigrants. And so I know that when the economies really start to, so I think 6 months from now, we will likely see a different posture, because whether it's the farm labor in the United States, whoever is picking the fruits and all of those types of things requires labor. So I think they will come to their senses eventually in relation to this trade war and this immigration matter. But in the meantime, Barbadians must be prepared for the fact that there will be some further disruption in relation to it, and therefore the efforts that we are mounting at home, especially within the agricultural space, working with Ghana and Suriname, we must accelerate to make sure that we can shield ourselves from the worst impacts.
Ryan, we're about to land, and this is absolutely about you now. This is the seventh year in public service. Your seventh year in public service. Having said that, how would you reflect on those 7 years, especially as it relates to your tenure as minister in the Ministry of Finance? And indeed, how would you describe the ebbs and flows there have been?
Let me just say publicly that the staff at the Ministry of Finance, I mean, they're great. They've been through every possible scenario that you think that is possible to go through. From people calling, want to know when they can get paid at the very beginning of the program, and people being very persistent about the fact that they provided goods and services to government and they want to know when they'll be paid, and people didn't have an answer for that immediately. I think we were able to address largely all of those concerns that people had. Of course, without the commitment, and I think those officers have gone beyond the call of duty at times to be able to make sure that Barbados remains on track. And I really want to thank them for that. But I think anybody who understands working in the Ministry of Finance will be aware that in an economy such as ours, the key is to find the right balance to have businesses, large or small, be confident to invest in the country. And as I look around Barbados today, whether it is the people up by Salters who are doing that little food court, that is investment, that has created jobs. Whether it is the houses, the residential houses that are being built up, Barbadians are now owning right across Barbados, that is people making personal investments in the country, which is in a sense a demonstration of confidence that the economy will work. But as the hotels building right down here in Bridgetown, people are committing to getting these things done. So I think at all levels, we've tried to make sure that we can clear the deck, so to speak, that any level of investment in the country, that people will have that confidence and know that if I put up $10,000, I can be able to get about that $10,000 by being able to work hard and make sure that I do what I have to do. And I think that so long as people continue to see that light, quote unquote, I would be happy to know that the job that we have been doing for these last 7 years certainly has been a successful one, because if people are prepared to take a chance in Barbados, then I'm happy to see them take that chance. And the Ministry of Finance is prepared to facilitate people taking those chances.
Well said, Ryan. Finally, and this question here will definitely pique the interest of your constituents in Christchurch East Central. Now, another election cycle is on the way, and I suppose your eyes on the trilogy. I'm sure it is. You know, I'm surprised if it isn't. So it is against that background I ask, how would you defend your record of service to the constituents of Christchurch East Central, who elected you in 2018 and again in 2022? What would your submissions be as you make those closing arguments for re-election?
Well, I think the absolute honest answer to that question is that we have, and certainly my representation of the constituency has been on multiple fronts. And whilst we haven't been able to do everything within the constituency in the time frame that I would like, and by the same token, things have not happened nationally in the same way that I would like, I think my response to that would be keep the faith with respect to the track record. And things are now moving in a direction that I would like to see happen faster. We have to, there's still some work to do. And As we are entering now 3.5 years or so since the last election, I think it is important for people to realize that the future of the country rests with the future of the constituency.
Yeah,
and I don't say that lightly. I think I've been able to represent their interests very well. I think I've been able to represent Barbados's interests very well. And I want to continue representing both those interests. And with their support, then I know that we can get it done, not just on their behalf, but on behalf
of all Barbadians.
Barbadians.
Excellent. Now, very one last item. As I arrived at the airport this afternoon, I received this letter from this guy who said something, but he wants me to read this letter to you. Have you ever heard of BAM?
Of
BAM.
Oh, yes, of course.
BAM is the Barbados Association of Married Men. Have you ever heard about that? Well, listen. It says here, the extent to which the stores at the Garrison Savannah have contributed to the Barbados economy has been understated by the powers that be for many years. Despite the fact that BAM is pleased with this year's budget, we regret that there have yet to be there once again isn't any concessions given to the night stores at the Garrison. I'm aware that the Honorable Minister Ryan Strachan will be on your flight today. So, we at the Barbados Association of Married Men, BAM, are petitioning him to take the VAT off all goods and services sold at the stores at the Garrison Savannah in order to inspire more night shopping in that area. That is from the president of BAM. Sir Ryan, you know, you just said you're mad and listen to the voices of the people. Listen to the voice of the people. That's the president of BAM. And his name is actually Sign
Ryan is in stitches.
Cyril BAM.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
Oh, my word. Oh, my
I know
word.
You didn't see that coming. You didn't see that letter coming. I know. There you go. You have to expect the unexpected on this flight. There you go.
Oh, gosh.
So that was minister in the minister.
Ministry.
The Ministry of Finance, Ryan Strachan. Thank you so much, Ryan. I mean, we've heard a lot about you today, man. You know, we've heard this whole... From
pleasure.
Then to
a
now,
pleasure.
I know that we leave out anything. Talk about you being a school teacher. We talk about what happened to you, man. brother can't compose himself. What's going on here?
It was well put together. Oh my goodness.
Oh God. All you gotta do is take the vodka. That's all you gotta do.
Oh,
anyway, thank you, Ryan. God bless you. And thank you for your service to the nation once again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Airport will be landing shortly. In preparation for landing, please ensure that your seat belts are securely fastened and your tray tables stowed. Our cabin attendants will be coming around the aisles to retrieve any service items you may have used on board our flight this afternoon. This is the end of flight 104 to Classics for today, March 16th. It has been an absolute delight bringing it to you on behalf of my guest, Minister Ryan Strawn, for Play Deli Sharjah Mall, this radio station, and my co-pilot, Malcolm X. This is Captain Forrester saying good night. And don't forget, next week, we'll be talking music with Lawrence Brewster and Damian Neblett. Remember to walk on the sunny side of the street. Good night, everybody.